Celine already thoroughly warned me that the audience here is very broad, so I should keep my talk in a on a comprehensible level. So I apologize for the very technical abstract. I will not talk about all the details that are in the abstract. So the plan for today is to give you an overview of where does this work fit into the general field of quantum gravity? What's the approach we are taking? Why it is interesting to study? And then towards the end of the talk, give you maybe a little bit more details on this particular work. Okay, so as you guys know, there are many different ways, or there's a sizable number of ways to think about quantum gravity. One way that I like to think about this is via the holographic principle. Now, the holographic principle, in a nutshell, basically relates a theory of quantum gravity in d plus one dimension to a quantum field theory in one dimension lower, so in d dimension. That's the basic upshot of the holographic principle. And I would say the first pointers to such a principle could exist, I think, are the black hole thermodynamics, where the entropy of a black hole is not given in terms of its volume, like the volume that the event horizon encloses, as you would naively expect maybe from thermodynamics, but it's encoded in the surface area of the black hole. So if you want all of the relevant quantum gravity information, or the quantum information that makes up the black hole, is located on the horizon of the black hole. And that's kind of the leading principle that I think is useful to keep in mind when talking about holography. So that you have some highly dense form of quantum information, or all the quantum information that is relevant to describe your physical system is condensed in your boundary. And there's a holographic way where how you can describe gravity in terms of this quantum information. Okay, the most famous example, I think, and the way people usually first come into contact with the holographic principle is via the so-called ADS CFD correspondence. Now, why is that? Well, the first explicit example of a holographic correspondence was found in the context of string theory and does involve exactly this combination of an anti-de Sitter spacetime and a conformal field theory as the dual quantum field theory. And I think one of the main reasons why this is such a, like, I think there are two main reasons why this has been so successful. One of which is, first of all, this is a so-called strong weak duality. So that means, as the name suggests, it relates a strongly coupled theory with a weakly coupled one. So, for example, gravity at strong coupling to a weakly coupled CFT, but also the other way around. And a lot of interesting work, I think, I wouldn't say almost all of it, but there's lots of interesting work actually went the other way. So people weren't trying to understand quantum gravity, but were actually trying to understand strongly coupled systems, strongly coupled CFTs, or like in condensed matter physics, where ADS CFT has also found lots of interesting applications. And the second one is anti-de Sitter spacetimes or conformal field theories appear almost anywhere in physics. It's like if you just look closely enough, and if you're smart enough, you can find some ADS factors popping up in near horizon geometries of black holes, or some conformal symmetries popping up elsewhere, which gives you hope that you can apply all the techniques that have been worked out with the holographic principle. Now, quantum gravity in general is a very complex field, I think, as would everybody agree in this room. And there are a couple of ways on how you can try to make your life a little bit easier. And one of them is to look at toy models. And one possible toy model you can look at is just, okay, instead of looking at four dimensions, you could try to learn maybe some fundamental things from three dimensions. So if you go to 3D gravity as a toy model, there might be some things you can learn about the holographic principle in general that might also be useful for higher dimensional purposes. And in 3D gravity, mainly in ADS3 CFT2, there have been lots of interesting conceptual results obtained in the context of the holographic principle. Now, why is that? Well, there are a couple of reasons for that. I think the most important one to mention is 3D gravity is locally trivial. So if you look at the bulk of your space, if you just take vanilla Einstein gravity, you don't have any propagating degrees of freedom. The only interesting degrees of freedom that you have are the ones you obtain via imposing boundary conditions on 3D. So that's what people usually in that field would call boundary gravitons, for example. Like, if you choose your boundary conditions appropriately, you get some propagating degrees of freedom, but only on the boundary. So to give you a picture associated with that. So this is the Penrose diagram of ADS3. It's just a cylinder. And the statement I made was just like, OK, if you now impose boundary conditions, let's say you just pull in a certain way, you fix how your metric looks like at the boundary. This will tell you how your boundary quantum field theory will look like. And the most famous example for such boundary conditions, I have to say there are many boundary conditions that you can choose. And all of those give you different symmetries on the boundary and different theories, putative dual quantum field theories. But the most famous ones, I think, are the so-called Brown-Hinault boundary conditions. And what do they do? If you impose these boundary conditions, then here on your boundary, you get two copies of the Virasoro algebra. And not only that, you get two copies of the Virasoro algebra with two central charges, which are the same. Now, L here is your ADS radius, so the radius of the curvature of your ADS, and G is Newton's constant. And you know, with a lot of hindsight, that paper, I think if I remember correctly, it came out in the 80s. That came out before ADS CFT. That came out before any ideas about the holographic principle were out. So with a little bit of hindsight, you could say, well, this is actually the first pointer to something like a holographic principle in 3D gravity. Because then you say, oh, nice, cool. Here I have a CFT living with these central charges. Let's compute stuff. Let's see if we can understand things that are happening in the bulk in ADS3 using this CFT. And maybe just to give you two examples that I myself particularly like very much. One of them is, for example, you can use this quantum field theory to count the microstates of BTC black holes. So ADS3 gravity, that's another reason why ADS3 has been studied so intensively. It allows for black hole solutions. So even though they're in 3D, only in ADS, as far as I know, you have black hole solutions in vanilla Einstein gravity without any additional matter. And there's a very neat way, like you can make a state counting on the CFT. You can compute the surface area of your BTC black hole, and they match. So that means you have a way of understanding the entropy of your BTC black hole in terms of CFT quantities, which is very nice.
Can I ask a question? Yes. Historically, I guess, like, to what extent when they give credit to, like, Wand's work for ADS CFT, mm-hmm. like, the fact that there's a string theory construction mm-hmm. to show that they're actually equal, but I guess if these are defined so they're equal, and if they're able to do microstate counting, why isn't it just the first, or, like, do you know sociologically what it's missing compared to the RD cases where you know the UV completion, or?
You mean historically?
Like, if you're doing microstate counting and you have an equivalence where you can represent it as a CFT or mm-hmm. as a 3D gravity theory, what is it missing to make it say, like, that's the first example of a holographic principle?
Oh, that's a good question.
I think, there is no microscopic content of brain and stuff. It's like just purely asymptotic symmetry of classic
algebra. Yes, I mean, it's on the level, you see that those two expressions match.
Yeah.
But I mean, you also can get string theory solutions that have ADS3 factors,
yeah.
Right? So, but yeah, maybe that's just a thing that's missing.
Look, brain. I don't know any of like brain, like, I don't know, like explicit microscopic like configurations
yeah.
of string that, and then you kind of, I don't know, yeah, maybe that's.
But there is also another issue, I would say, which is the fact that to count the microstate in the CFT, you have to assume that this is this dual CFT. So you have to assume holography to prove holography.
Well, you have to assume that the central charge is large,
yeah.
Basically.
And you have to assume that what you are counting are microstate of something. That's the point, right? As you are saying, since there is no brain construction coming from some compactification, when you are counting something there, you have to assume holography to say we are counting microstates.
But there's two different ways of counting it, though, right? Maybe that's the question.
What
yeah, yeah.
Andy did in 98
yeah.
was counting
like
in the CFT.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I essentially assume that people go to a CFT to show that that's counting.
Let's say that that's part of the dictionary to link what is happening between the bulk and the boundary. Like the central charge are like, the fact that they are the same is, if you want, that's part of the dictionary. And after you can build on to have this.
Yeah,
but
I'm saying
link.
Prior to 97,
yeah.
So in the 11 years that went between Brown and Noah, and as you correctly were saying, was in the 80s, so 11
yeah.
years.
Yeah.
People didn't count that because they never assumed they were counting microstate of something. They knew this was like a double copy, but Virasoro, they knew it as a CFT structure, but...
In the paper, they were just saying, oh, there is a symmetry of a conformal
yeah.
field theory there, but that's it, they weren't...
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
So they could count states and mesh through an area model, right? So it's...
I mean, you wouldn't go in the Cardi regime without knowing that there is a CFT.
Okay.
I would say.
Okay.
Maybe you can... What do you think?
Yeah, I think it. Okay. Yeah, I think it's. I mean, you're right. You can. Yeah. You can count something, but you don't know what you're counting.
Sure.
If yeah, yeah, that's
okay.
The point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you're counting.
I'm afraid
yeah.
of asking this question if you can't agree on the string, so I'm like, how do we learn something?
Okay, then maybe to give you a second example, because I learned over the last couple of days that there's also a number of people who are interested in these things. The second example that I always like to bring up when introducing these things is entanglement entropy. So let's say you have a conformal field theory, a 2D CFT, with one time and one spatial coordinate, and you decide to divide your system into a system A and its complement B. And then you want to know, okay, what's the amount of entanglement between system A and its complement? And one way, I mean, there are different ways of associating an amount of entanglement to these subsystems. One of them is computing the entanglement entropy, which is basically the trace of the reduced density matrix. So that's rho A. And rho A. Where you trace out the degrees of freedom of system B. So rho is the density matrix associated to your system. So that would be the thing you want to compute. And I mean, this doesn't look horrible, but the more complex your system gets, the harder it gets to compute these things. Like as soon as you go up in dimensionality or if you make your Hilbert space larger, things get complicated. That's the bottom line. And then in 2006, there was a very neat proposal by Liu and Takayanagi. And the basic idea was, or they realized, that, okay, take again ADS3, take a cutoff surface very close to your asymptotic boundary, and then attach to this cutoff surface, it's very close to the boundary, a space-like geodesic that connects basically these two boundary points. So this was would basically be the boundary picture of this one. And then they realized, oh, the entanglement entropy is basically proportional to the length of that minimal area surface. So in other words, you have a holographic way of computing entanglement entropy, a potentially very complicated observable to compute in the CFT, by means of computing geodesics in vanilla 3D Einstein gravity in ADS, which is arguably not a very complicated thing to do. And this also kind of is, at least how I see things, is a manifestation of a very nice connection between quantum information and geometry. So it is kind of, for me, the best toy example you can, or the best argument as a toy example you can make that quantum information translates into geometry. Okay, so that's basically the neat ADS3 stuff in regards to holography. Now let's slowly but steadily move to the title of my talk.
Max, can I ask a question? I don't want to interrupt the flow, but how do you think about the geometry reconstruction in the topological theory? Like you made the example of entanglement entropy in Yuta Karyanagi in 3D. So do you think this RT surface is like reconstructing the interior geometry in a theory which has no local degree of freedom? Does it make sense?
Well, I mean, you can still use. So I've never done this myself. So I've never done the computation myself. But I know that there are ways how you can reconstruct the Einstein equations, at least to first order, coming from entanglement entropy. So there are ways how you can massage these expressions to reobtain the Einstein equations. I think so. In that way, the correct Einstein equations to first order. So in that way, you can use this to reconstruct the bulk in these theories. That's how I would phrase it.
But in this theory, if I reconstruct like 20 kilometers of the interiors, I reconstruct it all immediately, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean that's
weird to me, but
yes. I mean, and on a practical level, this is just a side remark. So I've mostly worked with Trans-Siemens theories of gravity, so where you basically switch from having the metric as your dynamical field to a gauge field as your dynamical field, which is nothing else than the local dreibein and the spin connection. And in that case, it's exactly that, precisely what you said is actually happening. You can actually gauge away the radial dependence in your gauge field completely. So that what you have in your boundary, in a sense, for practical purposes, is the same everywhere as soon as you go into the bulk. And this radial direction seems a little bit superfluous. But if you want to give it an interpretation in terms of geometry, it actually is important. So, but yeah, there is a way of thinking about it like this. OK, then maybe let's jump to the next thing, which I hope is also interesting for a lot of people here. So OK, I've talked about a lot now about ADS CFT. If you just look at Einstein gravity, well, this is not the only solution of Einstein gravity you can imagine, right? There's also flat space, for example. So you could also think about, what about flat space holography, right? How does that work? And this is basically where this thing fits in and where I actually spent most of my adult life, adult in the sense as a non-grad student anymore in physics. And I have to specify also in 3D. So here I've basically hidden a 3D somewhere. And for the people familiar with the subject, how things are done in, or how things were approached in 3D is a little bit different than in 4D, like the methods used and what people mean by holography. And maybe just let me draw the picture to illustrate on what I mean when I say flat space holography in 3D. So this is the Penrose diagram of Minkowski. And if you look at this diagram, like in comparison to the ADS Penrose diagram, in the ADS Penrose diagram, it's kind of obvious when I say boundary what I mean. It's basically this part of the cylinder, like the non-filled part of the cylinder. If you look at flat space, there are basically a priori one, two, three, four, five disjoint boundaries where you could think about doing holography in principle. The first question you should ask is, okay, where should I do what? And historically, people have been mostly focusing on Scribe Plus. The main reason, I think, for that is, and sorry, and equivalently here, it's basically people focusing on null infinity. The main reason for that is that, very similar to the Brown-Hinault case, and just to emphasize it again, I'm not talking about 3D. The reason for that is that there are very powerful symmetries at work. Like, if you choose the right boundary conditions, and with right I mean boundary conditions that give you that, you get the so-called Bondi-Metzner-Sachs group in three dimensions. And in three dimensions, this is extremely powerful. We're talking about a symmetry that's on the same level as two copies of the Virasoro algebra, so like an infinite dimensional group that consists of the semi-direct product of the diffeomorphisms of the circle. So with circle here, I mean the celestial circle, and supertranslations. So supertranslations are basically translations that at every point on the celestial sphere act differently. So it's basically phi-dependent translations. And that gives you loads of things you can do. It gives you lots of power, potentially. And the 3D approach, for most parts, was, OK, we take these symmetries seriously. We try to define a quantum field theory at Scribe Plus or Scribe Minus that has BMS3 as their underlying symmetries. Then what you can do and what you can try to do is, and what people have been doing is, OK, then you try to compute things, again, observables on the boundary, and try to match them with things in the bulk. So that's one of the reasons why I brought up this example, because I think it's a good way of, and this one in particular with the thermal entropy, because it's two examples that people, and that also included myself, like especially this computation in flat space, have been able to reproduce. So, for example, one thing you can do is you can ask about entanglement entropy. Is there a sensible way to define entanglement entropy in BMS3? There seems to be one. Okay, so you get an expression for entanglement entropy. And then the question is, okay, can you find a prescription that is similar to the Ryotake-Nagi prescription? So in other means, can you find a minimal area surface in the bulk that reproduces your entanglement entropy? And the answer is yes, that you can do. So that's one thing. The next thing, the second thing you can do is, okay, flat space, unfortunately, doesn't have black hole solutions like ADS does. But it has something else. It has cosmological solutions. So these are called flat space cosmologies, and short FSC. And you can also do something. You can also associate to these cosmological solutions. So they're not black holes, but they have a cosmological horizon. To this cosmological horizon, similarly to a BTZ black hole, you can associate an entropy. And this entropy you can reproduce by the BMS analog of a Cardi formula. So you see that these two match. So in a sense, yes, it's a little bit fucked up, excuse my language, but I was about to draw it anyways later on, but it's an excellent question, yes.
And you said black holes are always?
Sorry, no, it's not a black hole, it's a cosmological. It's, right? I mean, if you look at it, it's, let me just write the thing, let me complete the thing, and I think then you might see what it looks like. So this is like Schwarzschild rotated by 90 degrees, yeah. If you look at it. Yes, this is what a flat space cosmology looks like. And this would be the horizons where you can associate an entropy to.
And so why are you scared of Schwarzschild if you're not scared of that?
No, I'm not scared of Schwarzschild. I'm just saying, it, like, if you first look at this, it looks weird. And if you look at Einstein gravity without any additional matter, that's the next best thing to a black hole we have in that holographic correspondence. Yes, yes. I mean, if you would add matter to the game, then of course you could produce black holes via collapse. But another reason why flat space holography, like if you call this flat space holography in 3D, another reason why this is very desirable is that in many instances, I would say you should actually be able to do it in all, but in many circumstances, you can take limits from known ADS results to flat space by sending the cosmological constant to zero. Taking the limit itself usually is not tricky, it's the how. You have to understand how it works, and that's what makes it tricky. And in a sense, maybe I think it's also, it might also help you with your question, Sabrina. This BTC black hole, if you take a limit of that, mm-hmm. you actually end up with this.
Okay.
It's not like the limit
where
just...
Where's the horizon?
Yes, very good, very good. So you actually take the limit of a rotating BTC.
Okay.
And imagine you're sitting in the ergosphere of the BTC, and the outer horizon of the BTC basically becomes null infinity, and the inner horizon is what remains. That's a rough way to think about this. It's not obvious to see that in the usual ADM form or in the Pfefferman-Graham gauge that is mostly used in 3D. What you actually have to do to see this is to write the BTC in a gauge that's basically the Bondi gauge for ADS.
Yeah.
Then you can take the limit, and then you will see all these things happening.
Yeah. But I would have thought you could try to, I mean, like, that there are different ways where you could try to make it go to normal sky and not to be,
Okay, but that's the cosmological solution story. I mean, that thing will actually pop up later on, most likely. I try to avoid as many formulas as possible currently because I think it's nicer if you hear the concepts. And so this would be my general introduction as to why is it interesting to study holography from a quantum gravity perspective, and how does the way I think about flat space holography fit into this picture. Now let's move on to that part. I think you can see already here the BMS part. I hope I was able to motivate you why it's interesting to study that well, because it's relevant for flat space holography. The U1 part might not be so obvious. There are a couple of reasons why it's interesting to study the addition of the U1 fields. It's mostly related, like there are some condensed matter examples for where all of a sudden a BMS symmetry pops up, because the reason is, I think it's on almost any null manifold, you can find BMS if you just look hard enough. And sometimes it's more obvious, sometimes less. And there are also condensed matter applications where this is relevant, and there they often have additional excitations flying around. And that's one of the reasons why it's interesting to study U1. So to basically, that's the way how you usually sell these things. I personally just find it interesting to, you know, look at extensions and see what's happening. Okay, so now what was the whole point of the thing we did? Well, if you have a BMS3 field theory, there are three things you need to completely specify your theory. One is the central charge, and I will show you in a second what I mean by those. The second is the spectrum of primary operators. And the third ones are the structure, the three-point structure functions, structure constants, that are not fixed by symmetry. Because it's like in a 2D CFT, one and two pi functions are completely fixed by symmetries, and three-point functions up to the structure constants that are not fixed by symmetry, and those you have to compute. And number three, this is precisely what we did here. So we first took a BMS3 field theory, we deformed it with a U1 current. Then we used that to compute the structure functions and also did a holographic computation to compute the same thing. Or in other words, to give the three-point function a holographic interpretation. The three-point coefficients, a holographic interpretation. Okay, now in order to explain to you one and two, I have to write some things down. But I hope it's not too boring for you. I think this might actually be interesting. So this is the BMS3 algebra. And I think for the people working in 4D, they will immediately see some very striking differences in comparison to the 4D case. And I will explain to you in a second what these things are. Let me also add the U1 part, just that it's here. So I'm just going to write for a couple of seconds, and then I'm going to explain these things. Okay, two more, and we're done. Yes, so P and J are the Fourier modes of your U1 symmetry. So there are actually two U1s in the game. The L's are the Fourier modes of your superrotations. And in 3D, I think the biggest difference is that we have the full Virasoro algebra from the start. So we have the full diffeomorphisms on the celestial circle. And the M's are the Fourier modes of the supertranslations.
So, but then why? Why are two U1s, and why is the transition
switch? So the reason why there are two is a little bit related again to the limit coming from ADS.
Yeah.
Because in the ADS case, there have been computations that involve Virasoro plus U1.
Yeah.
And the easiest way in flat space to construct models like this without too much guesswork is taking a straight up limit from two copies of ADS results. So if you would do the limit here on the level of the Virasoros, I'll just write it down because it's good if people have seen it once. So let's say you have here generators L, N, and this we call L bar N, for example. Then you could do something like this. Where you send epsilon going to zero.
Yeah.
And that's how you would go from two copies of the Virasoro algebra to the BMS algebra in the limit of epsilon goes to zero. That's also an easy way to see why the supertranslations here have to commute and these things. And the same you can do on the level of the U1s. That's why there are two U1s in the game. So the operational way to get to this is now you look at Virasoro plus U1 plus Virasoro plus U1. And you take a limit like this, and then you end up with this. This is just, it's operationally easy to set up these things and to get interesting examples out of this.
And then would N like P be like something times J, or is there something asymmetric about J and P?
Which one do you mean?
Sorry, the third bracket, is there another one? Like, third one. So
this one?
So
MM?
Third one, right. M with J?
M with J?
Yeah.
This one, yeah. This is another P.
And then M with P is zero?
Yes, everything I've not written is zero, yes.
Okay, yes. So M with J and P are not like the same as each other.
Yes, 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 yes. So you see that basically the structure itself mimics again the semi-direct product structure of BMS. And I mean, that's on purpose. To keep things simple. And maybe the most important things to point out here are because I just wanted to make point number one, are the central extensions. So those are basically, this is point number one, if you want to classify your theory. And maybe as a side remark, because I know in 4D there's been lots of discussions about whether or not BMS4 has central extensions, or like the CCFT has a central extension. In 3D Einstein gravity, the Virasoro part does not have a central extension, so you just have the width algebra. But this guy is non-zero. The CM part is non-zero in 3D flat space. I mean, there are ways of also getting a non-serial Virasoro central extension, but they usually involve TMG or other things. You have to introduce an additional scale such that you actually can have a dimensionless number here. And this guy is dimensionful, actually. So this one is proportional to 1 over Newton's constant. Maybe just as for the 40 people who know.
In 40, you say there would also be a central term there, or there wouldn't be in the analog of the super translations and super...
I don't think there is, as far as I know. Maybe Celine knows more, but...
There would be no analog of, like, what you were saying, like the fact that there's a non-zero central charge for the super translations.
So you compare, like, what exactly the super rotation are. I mean, you have all these shifts, so I'm not sure, like,
I mean, I have to say, on the algebraic level, like, 3D is considerably easier than 4D.
Like, the super rotation are independence, some extensions. So
Max?
Yes?
What is a dimensionful central extension?
Ah, yeah. You mean conceptually, or what it's in this case?
No, in conceptual.
That's a good. That I think I cannot properly answer. I mean,
No, it's not. It runs, right?
Yes, and it's like, I mean, you're right, Luca. It's like this thing only has like the exact value of that object doesn't have physical meaning, right? It's just is it positive, negative, or zero? That's the only thing.
That was my second question, which is unitarity in this theory.
Yeah. Okay. My comment? Okay, yeah. Okay, so unitarity...
You can be zero comments.
Okay, no. I mean, that's perfectly fine. Let me make maybe two comments associated to this. I mean, those are two very good questions. Like, the first one is, let me maybe just write it down, what it is. That's how it looks like for Einstein gravity. G is Newton's constant. Now, as you point out correctly, it's like usually if you speak about a central charge, it's a number. And in the CFT, usually that number counts something, like number of states or something. What does this thing do? Well, if you do computations like in these BMS field theories, you actually never only have this guy. You always are looking at ratios with respect to that guy that again gives you a dimensionless number. So this is something that will show up in a second. Maybe just let me write that down, explain it, and then go back to unitarity, okay? Because I think that might make things a little bit clearer. Because let me just first show you how to label states. So now I'm telling you one way of labeling states. So let's say you have a state psi. And one way of labeling it is like this. Okay, so that's one way of labeling your states. So this would be what we call also very similar to CFD, like a conformal weight. This would be something like the energy of your state, and these would be the U1 charges. And if you pay close attention to this, the main reason why this guy has a physical dimension is because also this M has a physical dimension. How can you see that? Well, this guy is basically 1 over L in disguise. That's where this comes from. And just to finish what I said before with the ratio, maybe that explains the question already. The thing that almost always pops up in any observable that you compute is actually this. So you see, this guy has a physical dimension, actually the same as CM. So the thing that's relevant whenever you're talking about something being large, something being small in relation to this central extension, you're always talking about a ratio of these things. So you get the dimension out of the system. Yes?
Okay, this might not be a well-posed question, but so roughly speaking, when people talk about GD CFTs, they often kind of just change signatures. I know they continue all the time. Mm-hmm. And naively, like, I'd be scared to do that on this scribe.
You're absolutely right, yes.
But in principle, though, like, if you understood how to get BMS for all 5 components, then there's a sense in which the BMS action, like I0 versus I plus or I minus, is, like, acting on the, like, quick rotation of, like, or some analytic continuation of the time coordinates. Like, there's a spatial... Is that... reasonable way to think of trying to define Euclidean BMS field theory,
taking all boundaries into account?
Basically having the BMS action near I plus and think of that physical hypersurface as like Euclidean and
That's a good question, and I don't have an answer to that. Because as you correctly point out, an Euclidean version of whatever I'm talking about here seems weird.
Right?
Yes.
But like, people do that all the time. And
I know, I know.
So like, I guess it was,
yes.
If they say Euclidean instead of I plus, then maybe, I don't know.
Sorry. Yes, yes. No, I mean, that's absolutely right. And I mean, it is a constant point of confusion what's happening in certain computations.
Yeah.
Because some things we're so used to doing Euclidean signature from a CFT
yeah.
that also like what I'm going to talk about, or like maybe just allude to,
yeah.
maybe let's leave it at that.
Yeah.
Things like modular transformations are very tightly linked to Euclidean signature and doing things in Euclidean
yeah.
signature. And the funny thing is you can do these things in these BMS quantum field theories. You can apply these things that are actually deeply rooted in Euclidean techniques, and they still somehow work.
Can we say that we're doing that near IPLUS then? Maybe? Sorry,
I don't know, to be honest.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a way of phrasing it, but I don't know, to be honest. I don't have an answer to that.
The BMS plus that people have found near at IPLUS,
yeah.
seen as a paraboloid,
yeah.
the null time is actually the radial coordinates, so it's kind of weird.
No, but it should be, so like I want to say that that's like the cap you had at the bottom of the ABS cylinder, right, in that context, I don't know what the time direction is in that. When
like,
people talk about preparing states in ABS CFT in terms of Euclidean things, they add a cap at the bottom,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of naturally like the role of I plus
and Yeah, but if you go to I plus and I minus and you take the BMS null direction, it will point like this, it will not point like this.
Sure, but isn't that true for the cap story? Like in the when I try to prepare, say, to the origin of like this, and then evolve to the cylinder, like the rate of inversion.
No, they're still null, so they still wrap each other, no? The two directions.
I think it's.
Or is it like this? I don't know.
I think it's Euclidean.
I think it's
Euclidean at the cap.
Right? Maybe it's the same. Yeah. I don't know.
But also I also don't have a conclusive
yeah.
answer to that. I have
yeah.
to say, but it's been bugging me for a little bit.
Sorry. Does that a lot? I worked with on the Euclidean side. Never try to understand. He does discuss a lot this connection between the Lorentzian side and the Euclidean side of BMS.
Which author
was it? Glenn Barnish?
Yeah,
I would have to send you these specific. These are very specific.
Is it the one loop partition function thing?
Yeah, it can compute the partition function of 3D flat space on the Euclidean side, but you find the BMS character.
Okay.
Even
non-analytical.
Yeah, but there the Euclidean part is like they're doing the heat kernel computation, right? In the bulk.
Yeah, but you can do that actually
yeah.
much simpler, which we did. You know, we don't need to do heat kernel.
Yeah. No, but like historically, that's the thing that like you do the heat kernel, and then you see this basically reorganizes into characters of BMS3.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that alludes to what you were asking before with the unitarity,
nice.
Luca. So maybe I'll just mention it because I think it's a point that has been discussed a little bit in the past by certain people, including myself. But I have the feeling nowadays people are not talking about that so much anymore. And the main thing is, because as, maybe let me write down the primary states and then you will see why this might be a tricky thing to talk about. So a primary state in this notation would be something like this. So this would be the notion of a primary state. And this is basically something that you would call a highest weight representation also in a CFT. And that thing in general has null states. So that thing is non-unitary if your CM is non-equal zero, which happens to be the case for Einstein gravity. You can easily see that if you look at the Gram matrix at level 2 already, you will see that CM gives you something with negative norm and you're not unitary anymore.
Can I ask you another
yes?
question about the null state story in the 40K service? I'm confused sometimes because of the fact that the Hermitian conjugation condition.
Ah, yes.
Is it the standard one for the 0-0?
Yes. Yes. In this one, it's the for this story, it's the standard one. And why I'm mentioning this is because then you can make connection to what Bianca actually said. The things like how Blaser computed things, and like we also like I also worked with Blaser on these things afterwards on higher spin and all how these characters work. Now there's a different kind of representation that you can use in 3D, which is called induced representations, which is from a group theoretic perspective maybe the more natural one to work with BMS, and that representation is unitary. And that representation is the thing that gives you the characters that Bianca mentioned and also matches up with the computation. Now, why are there two different things and why have they been used interchangeably? The main reason is, if you think about these in terms of a limit, this is not the only limit you can take. There's a sect like the Virasoro algebra as an automorphism that basically looks like this. And if you apply that automorphism here, you basically get the second contraction. This is usually referred to as a Carolian limit. Yeah. You can also get a Galilean limit, basically. So in one case, the light cone closes up, in the other one, it opens up. This representation, like if you start with highest weight representation in the Virasoro case, and you don't do this contraction, but the Galilean one, you'll end up with these representations. So highest weight representations map to highest weight representations. However, if you do this Carolian limit, then highest weight representations map to these induced representations that Blaser has been working with. But on an algebraic level, they both give you exactly the same algebra. It's like those two algebras are isomorphic. Physically, they mean something different, but on an algebraic level, they are the same. But since most of these things here are purely based on symmetries, yeah, they don't really care about whether or not you're working with Galilean conformal or BMS.
Yeah, but doesn't that sound kind of like you're going to like the same algebra on a surface that's either null or like, I guess, I don't know what the right picture is.
Maybe it helps, like the thing you're doing, you're basically exchanging time and space. So you would be exchanging retarded time. You would rotate everything by 90 degrees, kind of. That's what you're doing. Okay. But for all practical purposes, these representations work just fine if you ignore for a second that they are non-unitary and in the end exchange time and space. You will recover the things that you get from computing bulk observables in 3D flat space. So that's might be a good thing to mention. Okay, so that's basically number one and two from this list of points are done. The third one, I'll try to get this one done in 10 minutes. So maybe just let me be very hand wavy on the CFT side, just to illustrate how we would extract the three-point coefficients. So the basic idea is that you want to look at one-point functions. So, and in our case, since we want to reproduce this via some holographic computation at some point, we're actually looking at heavy, light, heavy structure constants. So that means we are looking at an operator in a very heavy background. So we have some very high energy state and a very, very light operator in the presence of that state. Maybe I'll do that parallel. What would that mean? In this case, holographically, the heavy state would be a flat space cosmology. And we just put a very, very light scalar field somewhere. That would be our operator that we would be looking at. And what you can do is you can directly write this as basically a trace of your operator times the partition function of your theory. So that partition function you can write down. And operationally, what you're doing is, first you write this, you replace the trace as a sum over eigenstates. And now I'm just saving up space. And this guy is nothing else than the density of states. The density of states depends on your conformal weights. I just won't write this here. And your three-point coefficients. So C psi n dagger O psi n. So the basic idea now is, OK, you convert this sum into an integral. You invert the whole thing to extract this guy. That's the rough idea. So Yes, C is the partition function. I haven't written it down, but you, there's a way, there's a sensible way of defining a partition function for these theories. And what you can now make use of is, I mean, solving this integral in general is not possible, it doesn't work. What you can do is, you can look at certain regimes. That's why I'm saying we were looking at heavy, light, heavy, because in that presence of a heavy background, you can actually project this object, so this guy here, you can project it onto the lowest lying primary. Then you can make use of the BMS version of modular invariance to get the expression you're interested in, basically.
You're looking at the expectation value operator like sitting on the global boundary here, right? Like,
yes, maybe. Yeah. So, yes. Yes, yes.
To me is a trace.
Yes, yes.
The thing that Z for you is like a path involved with some boundary. Like, why is the bracket around the Z?
About the notation, oh, yes, 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 yes. I apologize. Sorry. Sorry. I meant with C is a red. Maybe it's helpful to write the C. Yes.
Sorry.
Yes. I should. Sorry. That's actually confusing. I was saving too much notation here. I apologize. So it's actually. Yes, 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 absolutely, yes, yes, yes. I apologize for that blunder in notation, and then there's the U1 part. But that's the rough idea on how you would compute the thing on the quantum field theory side. That's basically, if you've ever done that computation in CFT, it's the same, but with these things and a little bit more fiddling around with physical interpretation on what these modular parameters actually mean, how they're related to angular to the angular potential and inverse temperature and all these things, that's a little bit more iffy. But on a technical side, it's basically the same. And I mean, Sabrina already alluded to how the thing should look like in the bulk. So maybe let me just draw a constant U slice of that thing that I've drawn here. So that's a constant U slice of the Penrose diagram over there. This is the location of the cosmological horizon. And what you're actually computing here is this guy, where the energy is the one of the flat space cosmology. And what you're operationally doing is, again, you're computing geodesics, because we're working in a limit where you can ignore back reactions of the scalar fields and the probes. And you basically have one scalar field that represents your operator that stretches from a surface. This is actually very close to the asymptotic boundary. It's not quite there. To the flat space cosmological horizon. And here it basically splits into two fields, like two charged fields that are oppositely charged that wrap around your cosmological horizon. And the basic idea is, well, now these two-point functions are all proportional to the mass of whatever thing you have. So A is here either O or chi. And chi is basically the conformal dimension of the lowest lying primary in your theory times the regularized geodesic length connecting each point. So here you just have the geodesic that connects asymptotic infinity to this point at the cosmological horizon. And here you wrap the cosmological horizon twice. And basically, if you compute that, you will see, okay, you get exactly the same expression as you got from the BMS computation.
Why is it easier for you to compute like heavy, heavy, light instead of just three, like, I mean, just three scalar fields and some, like, I guess, I don't know, correlation between the graviton and the boundary, or I don't know, if it's like an amplitude, I guess there's not an amplitude in 3D, so maybe that's why it's not easier for you.
Yes.
Like
Yes, 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 yes. And another reason was maybe just, you know, to advertise this. Yeah. If you know how things work in ADS, yeah, most of the time, yeah, in many instances, it doesn't require an awful amount of thinking to cook up a way how to do it in flat space. And that was also kind of a reason here it's one of the funny instances where it actually works exactly the same as in ADS. It's like if you want to do the same thing with a CFT and in ADS, it's actually exactly the same, but replace FSC with BTC, and you're there. It's not always the case. Like entanglement entropy is much nasty is the wrong word, trickier. Yeah, you want it to be like this, yeah, right? Yeah. Do you mean by something like wouldn't be a weak rotation, right?
I'm confused about, not that I have any intuition for anything, mm-hmm, but I would have thought if I wanted to look at an operator at Scry in a black hole background, that would be more natural, be more comfortable with it than something like
in this background.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would be nice, but vanilla Einstein gravity just doesn't give you the black hole. Or at least I don't know of any way how you can get a black hole solution without adding matter and collapsing it in 3D flat space.
There was an argument by Carlip also about 3D black holes in flat, which is that you can get this kind of solution starting from empty Minkowski 3 or ADS 3.
Like BTC.
Point identification. Yeah. And create a black hole solution like Swarovski in 3D would require to identify time. And so you are automatically creating, because you want a time-like singularity, so you're automatically creating CTCs everywhere, closed time-like curves.
And so
it's just physical, the solution itself. So, that was one argument I read, but that's, mm-hmm, I haven't thought about it very hard. Okay. So.
I see.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense to me.
Okay, that's good. Okay. Then I have to rephrase it, there are no black holes that don't, like, you know,
that makes
without
sense.
That makes sense.
Yes.
Well, kind of. You cannot do this kind of thing of, you know, taking a scalar field inside and compute
sure.
a one-point function. It wouldn't make sense because
sure,
it would not.
Sure.
Be.
Yeah, I'm done. I'm done. Yeah. That was the cut. That was the thing I wanted to basically tell you.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's why I was like, okay. Let's keep on going.
Could you maybe start by student questions? So,
I have two questions. So, the way that you compute the structural constants, you're using the state operator correspondence for psi. So, and you're assuming that this operator is local, right? The psi. So, what if it's not? Does that matter too much?
It's a good question. I don't know, actually.
Because I ask because, in, for example, criticalizing, you do have non-local operators,
mm-hmm,
and yeah, just kind of worried about that. The second question is maybe related. So I know that there are people in the condensed matter community that are starting to think about tripartite,
mm-hmm,
entropy, and that can actually take higher dimensional data in your theory. So I was wondering if there is some corresponding result, the RT thing.
So one thing, we had that discussion, I think on Monday already, or today again with Jackie, when we were talking about entanglement entropy in flat space. So for tripartite systems, you have to, these systems should better obey strong subadditivity, right?
Sorry.
Strong subadditivity is one of the basic things you would like to have for tripartite systems. And naively, it seems that for the entanglement entropy that you get in the flat space case, this does not seem to be the case. Modulo some things you might overlook when computing this. So this is not conclusive yet, but there hasn't been much thought or work on tripartite systems in that regards. I'm not sure if it's precisely because of that reason or whether or not people didn't have so much interest in those things recently. Another reason I think is that the holographic description or the accepted holographic prescription for entanglement entropy in like BMS field theories and flat space looks quite different than in ADS, because in ADS you can basically do all these neat little proofs for tripartite systems and strong subadditivity by just drawing things like this, right? And then like this, and it's like, yay, okay, you're done. I mean, I'm just exaggerating now, but that's roughly how you can argue things. And in flat space, that doesn't really fly, because what you basically have to do is you have to shoot light rays into a bulk to a certain point into the bulk. And depending on how your entangling interval looks like, they stretch different distances into the bulk. And then you have to attach space-like geodesics in between those light rays. And that makes everything related to tripartite and holographic proofs there quite a little bit more tricky to perform.
Why do you always want to go space?
So, and what was what exactly you assume about the representation? Is it irreducible or some direct sum of your representation?
There weren't, like, I think the only assumptions that are made are that it's a highest weight representation. I think that's the basic thing. Whether or not they're irreducible or not, I don't know from the top of my head. I would have to check it. Yeah.
So, and a curious comment is, one of the irreducible representations of the BMS, I think it matches with an irreducible representation of zero times zero, or zero times zero, zero.
Does it? Or is it a question or a statement? Sorry.
I think it's a statement.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's an interesting draw from this.
Okay.
So what is it between? Okay, I understand this question. He's saying that the like representation of your crossbar is also a representation of this, or
that's how I got this. But would it be a finite dimension representation or an infinite dimension?
No, infinite dimension.
Infinite dimension.
I think the vacuum representation, in the sense that one of the quadrant orbits of BMS is the cotangent bundle of GPS1 mod PSL2R. And
yes,
it has been shown that there's a non-trivial symplectic dimorphism to GPS1 mod PSL2R.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Let me just remind myself the PSL2. Okay. Okay. This quadrant orbit with the PSL2R. I forget which one that is. Does that include Minkowski, for example? Is that the one that includes Minkowski? Do you know that? I mean, we can also talk about this later if you want, because then it might be easier.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Yeah, I don't want to kill the question because that's interesting.
But if you
have the representation there and you do the inner contraction of the cosmological reference and away to zero, like, can you follow it through?
I think it's a bit harder than that. What Rodrigo refers to implies a symplectomorphism, so I don't think it's just a scaling limit.
Okay. Let's thank Max for his talk and see you all for
Yes.